and welcome to Not the Top 20 podcast, sponsored by Betfair. I am your host, George Ellick, today. Not often I do the intro, but Ali Maxwell is away having a well-deserved break, sunning himself with his wife on their honeymoon. So it is me alone. For those who have listened to this podcast for a long time, they may remember a very famous podcast of Ali's back in the infancy of Not the Top 20, where I wasn't available and Ali did a 1 hour monologue on the EFL happenings of that weekend. I don't think many broadcasters could do that. Adam Buxton, Ali Maxwell, not George Ellick. I wouldn't back myself to be able to speak without drawing breath for that long. And so thankfully for you, the listener, that is not the plan for this podcast. I have spoken to Matt Slater, a senior football reporter from The Athletic. It just felt like quite a good time after an FA Cup weekend to look at what's going on in the EFL post-COVID, post-fan-led review release, and Matt is better than anyone. We had him on the pod a few times in the past going through that. So I spoke to Matt, and that will be coming up shortly here. In terms of what's going on in the EFL, you know, it's been the World Cup. My eye has been slightly off the ball in the EFL after the arrival of my daughter. So apologies if in the interview with Matt you can hear some crying in the background. She is very young. She's very healthy and happy, which is great. I am quite tired, but it could be worse. But it's been a pretty normal time in the EFL, I would say. You know, things you would expect to happen are happening. You know, Mick Beale is bringing as much drama to West London as his namesake did to East, in terms of talking about the need for integrity and now being strongly linked to the Rangers job. Colo Touré is seemingly going to be manager of Wigan, if reported to be believed, to the hold-up, presumably him trying to get out of his residency at Ali Pali that he has every Christmas so he can take up the role there. Matthew Etherington has come out of obscurity to become manager of Crawley Town, assisted by Simon Davis, a dream for those of us who grew up playing, or not even grew up, maybe as adults, played Championship Manager 99-00. They've been working at Peterborough. Lewis Young, seemingly pretty unfortunate not to get the nod there, but interesting to see how they get on. Just normal EFL stuff, things you'd expect to happen nowhere apart from the EFL. But when my partner in crime, Ali, is back next Monday, we'll be able to go through all of these big stories on and off the pitch. And we'll also be chatting through some of the stars of the World Cup who play in the EFL as well. So you've got all of that to look forward to. We will be back. Normal service will resume again, as I say, when Ali's back next week. We'll be back with the betting show on Thursday as well with Nick Goff too. So look forward to that. But here is my chat with Matt Slater as we take the temperature of all things EFL. Delighted to be joined by Matt Slater, senior football news reporter at The Athletic, often focusing on matters off the field as well as on it. And you join us, Matt, from Qatar, where you are, of course, covering the World Cup. So before we get into all EFL matters, how's it been out there? How's the beginning of the tournament been, and what's the experience like?
It's hard to say. I mean, because it's these tournaments are just insane, you know, the pace of them, and you know, you can get just totally wrapped up in it and sort of forget what day it is. You forget to eat sometimes. It's been okay, you know. Sounds like I'm gamming it with faint praise. I'll be honest, I didn't have fantastic expectations of this tournament. I didn't think it was going to be awful. I just thought there would be you know, some challenges, some logistical challenges. You know, and I obviously reported on the whole controversy around how Qatar won the rights to stage this World Cup and all the other various controversies too. So, you know, I had those in my mind and I knew that I'd be reporting on those because those are the issues that I cover. And they've been problematic. You know, there's a lot of tension between the Western media and the Qataris and now the wider Arab world. And that's led to tensions between the media and FIFA, and so that's been a bit difficult. But you know, also as I expected, once the football started, the conversation, the mood would change, and it has. And the football's been good. The stadiums, I imagine, they look pretty good on TV because they're all new. you know, they're yeah, what do you expect? They're nice stadiums. The volunteers are good, really friendly. The metro's impressive, and yeah, and you know, there's a good atmosphere. There's a good atmosphere here. You know, is it sort of a typical World Cup? No, it was never going to be a typical World Cup. What is a typical World Cup? It does feel a bit contrived at times, a bit forced, inauthentic. But equally, moments of joy will pop up half a dozen times a day, and you'll sort of think, yeah, that's great. That is really, really good. That's totally real, totally authentic. And it can be, you know, Tunisian fans, Saudi fans, Japanese fans, you name it. And it's going pretty well. I mean, I just remind myself this morning that I've still got 3 more weeks. And see, but yeah, it's going well. I mean, how's your look on TV?
Yeah, great. I mean, given my current personal situation with a very young baby, having a Winter World Cup and 4 games a day has been incredible. I don't know if my wife would necessarily agree, although for the first time in over 10 years of being together, she's finally showing something of an interest in football. So maybe maybe it's doing something there. But I was in Russia as a fan, not working, and kind of in hindsight, I look back and I kind of remember some of the ridiculous things I said to friends and family when I got home, having spoken to Russians about Mr. Putin. And I look back now and I kind of feel like I was almost complicit in what was just a big propaganda campaign. And I guess a lot of journalists out there, I don't know whether you're in Russia and yourselves included, must almost check yourself from about 4 years ago and think as to what's going on now. And has that changed, do you think, the way that journalists and fans out there are approaching the whole, you know, more in the knowledge of what's actually going on behind the scenes?
I think so. I can't speak for all journalists, but, you know, it's become sort of commonplace now. There is this narrative here that Qatar's been completely unfairly picked on and it's totally unjustifiable. And the only possible explanation could be racism. You know, I push back against that because there are various bits that aren't true. First of all, there were some critical stories before going into Russia, not least around things like hooliganism, size of the place, cost, and then of course Crimea and the Salisbury poisoning. And it was a very diminished number of fans that went from Western Europe to Russia. However,
until England started doing well.
Well, exactly. But even then, it wasn't quite the numbers you might expect. Yes, but you're right. They did rock up for you know the quarter final.
I was there for Tunisia and Panama. You know, true hardcore.
Yeah. That is impressive. good. Well, Panama was a good one, wasn't it? But I think there is equally true that there's a feeling that Qatar has been under more scrutiny, that we weren't questioning enough of Russia, you know, once bit, twice shy. We've got to be more consistent. You know, if we're going to hold Qatar up to this standard, we needed to have held Russia up to a similar standard. And did we? Were we a bit sports washed? I think by the end of that tournament, we most certainly were. So that is true. I think it's equally true. You have to remember that there wasn't the same level of shock that Russia got the World Cup. One, because it was perceived to sort of kind of be its turn. It is and was a footballing nation. It wasn't that sort of, oh my God, you know, where has that decision come from? You know, Russia's been decent at football for a long time. Big place, you know, staged Olympics. You knew it could do it. So I don't think the two decisions were comparable. And then, of course, there's just a slightly more time, right? That was an 8-year run-up. This is a 12-year run-up. So, you know, I think if you factor all those things, it is true that looking back, we were soft on Russia. And Russia was emboldened. And FIFA, the West, etc., took their eyes off the ball. And Putin came away from that tournament strengthened and I think convinced that he could pretty much do whatever he liked. And that's all on us a little bit. But, you know, Qatar has different sets of challenges that it is still dealing with, making some progress. It's not consistent progress by a long stretch. It's not as advertised either, but it's making progress.
From Qatar then to the EFL. I don't know how we can segue that. It's probably as far apart as a Harry Suter 50-yard crossfield pass against France for Australia. It would be good to talk about the plenty of EFL players doing well at the World Cup. But I think I'll wait for Ali's return next week to do that, and we can wax lyrical about all of them. But let's talk about the EFL. And you know, you came on this podcast a couple of times. We had one, I remember, very sobering chat just before the COVID lockdowns, where I think Ali and I have spoken since and said that talking to you for an hour or so before the lockdowns was kind of the moment that both of us realized just how significant and severe COVID was going to be, not just in football, but in all of our lives. It does feel like, and this might be naive of me, you know, there were some serious existential questions and crises around football and the EFL throughout COVID and in the aftermath. It feels like we've come out okay the other side at this stage. Would you agree with that?
I would. Once again, football, English, British football, showed itself to be incredibly resilient. And, you know, particularly, you know, the first sort of 6 months or so of COVID, you know, coming into that second wave, so much concern, so much doom and gloom. A lot of negotiations, obviously, with government, but equally with the Premier League, money, emergency funds. And, you know, unless they're amazing poker players, the people I was speaking to, finance directors, chief execs, chairs of clubs, just thought this could wipe out, you know, 10% of clubs and leave them all deeply, deeply damaged. And you have to say, well done. You know, you got through. Maybe it was a massive panic, and it was the great unknown that, you know, my God, this is so new, this is awful. I'm struggling to see a way out of this. But they did get through, and there were sort of key moments of help that came. But I just think as a collective, they did well. I think you know, the EFL as an organisation gets a lot of stick, but they had a good COVID, as did the Premier League. I mean, there are still conversations to be had about the redistribution of money, of course, but British football, English football, I think did well, handled the crisis well, and that's, you know, that's you have to applaud that.
When talking of the redistribution of money in football, a year or so ago, we had Tracy Crouch come on the pod to talk us through the fan-led review. It felt like it gained massive momentum at the time. And as often things seem to do, once it gets past the stage of research, there seems to have been a bit of a block. And, you know, we saw Premier League executives coming out and making, frankly, ridiculous inflammatory statements about the findings in the report, comparing them to historical events, that was just totally and utterly disingenuous. And, you know, when Liz Truss came briefly into Premiership, you know, we were told that there was a likelihood that the whole fan-led review was going to be swept under the carpet. It seems to have gone fairly quiet recently. You know, we've seen Rick Parry talking in the media in the last couple of weeks, still maintaining that it is incredibly important, but it doesn't really feel like anything is being done. Where are we? You know, for those of us who saw this as being possibly kind of the golden egg and the saviour for plenty of you know, the long-term future of EFL clubs, are we in danger of losing what should have been an incredibly important bit of work?
We are in danger of it. But as you've outlined, that dangerous sort of ebbed and flowed. I think with all these things, there's momentum, right? And there was a key, you know, the European Super League did energise a lot of people. And of course, that included lots of Premier League fans, but it got government thinking about it. You had a sort of populist government at the time that thought a lot about Red Bull votes, and there is this perception that those guys are football fans. So Tracy Crouch was away you go, you know, see what you can find out. And she did a fantastic piece of work. Right at the beginning, though, I was concerned that there have been so many of these kind of restart moments in English football over the years, and they all tend to dissipate. They all tend, unless they're incredibly focused, like laser-like focus, they become very easy to talk down to just slow down. And I worried about it from the beginning, and the unity of purpose around, oh, this can't happen again. But it was like, well, what can't happen again? Because you've got, at times you're talking about Maxwell and Berry and very financial, governance related financial issues. Then we're kind of moving on to kind of breakaway leagues and the protection of community assets. And I just thought, and now we're introducing sort of a relatively complicated, certainly to football, element of independent regulation. It did seem a bit, where's the focus? I can just see the Premier League and the FA being able to put the brakes on here. And that's what's happened. I mean, there was equally some bad luck around, well, I suppose we'll try to see these things. The politics of the UK just going nuts, and massive distractions, and who's really in charge, and just legislative programs being ripped up. But you know, three prime ministers ago, two, I can't get lost. There was still, you know, a commitment to this. You know, it was a manifesto pledge. It was a Tory party idea. It was a former Tory sports minister that did the work. You had everyone kind of signed up to it. When MPs from all sides asked questions, the standard answer from DCMS was, yes, this is happening. That's part of the culture of media sport. And the DCMS minister, Nadine Dorries, was she was fully signed up for this as well. All right, so then we hit the summer and all hell breaks loose, and we emerge with this trust and the bonfire of regulation and red tape, and no, we're going to go completely the other way. Light touch regulation in all parts of the British economy. We're not really into that at all. Now, of course, this was music to the ears of the Premier League. They've been whispering in their, you know, whispering at them for months, as had the FA. So, yeah, we got to whenever that was, sort of August-ish, September-ish, with, oh, no, we have missed our moment again. But a couple of things happened. So the first was the advocates of the fan-led review, people like Fair Game, and there's lots of people behind the scenes, but the EFL really applied pressure on Labour and got Labour to fully sign up. So at the Labour Party conference, I think you might remember Gary Neville, Keir Starmer, Lucy Powell, you know, key Labour figures all saying, yep, we love it. As soon as we get in, we're doing that. Right, so there you go. As soon as we get in, we're doing that. Flying high on the polls, government in waiting. That applied pressure on the Conservatives. Now, very quickly, because there's so many things happening at once, Liz Truss falls apart. She's out. Rishi Sunak comes in. Now, Rishi Sunak, not that long ago, including on the hustings for that role when he lost the Truss, said, I still like that policy. I still sign up to that policy. We're in a bit of a limbo now. And clearly he's distracted, and that's fine. And in the great scheme of things, this isn't as important as some of the other stuff the country's facing.
Oh, Matt.
He was a member. Well, I know. Sorry, listen.
No, your audience.
Yeah, I know. Okay, it's massively important. But, you know, you have a guy who was a member of that cabinet. You have a guy who not that long ago said, no, I still like that idea. We had the lady who said, no, I don't want any regulation. She's gone, as is her, was her, you know, key advisor, and the guy called, I think, I can't remember his name now, so I'm not going to say it because I'll get his name wrong. But sort of the key people in number 10 her advisors, they're out. So what's the problem? We've got a new sports minister. We've got a new sort of DCS minister who isn't a sporty guy. But and their answers, their answers have been vague, right? So once upon a time, there was like a templated answer that came from DCMS. Yeah. White paper coming. Still like it. So now it's white paper coming. We are still consulting on the fan-led review, all elements of the fan-led review. So they've softened it a bit. But I still hear a lot of optimism. I still, you know, people that worked on it, political advisors, senior people within the game, they are mainly EFL people who are still convinced that we are edging being the opposite word here, towards pretty much full implementation of that review, including an independent regulator.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty from my point of view is seeing how it gets implemented. And I don't know if you could help with that, but when you read, for example, Baroness Brady's column in a certain national newspaper where she seemingly gets to unchecked talk about how it's the government taking over football, even though the fan-led review specifically states that it would be the independent regulator would not be a government figure and would be appointed, you know, away from government. Yet still that probably turns everybody who hates government against the fan-led review. And you think of the power and wealth behind the Premier League clubs, and you mentioned there who are allegedly or likely, campaigning against this behind closed doors, and then taking power away from the FA, who again possess lots of power. I mean, it does feel like, and then you have Labour politicising it further. You know, we like to think that our politicians act with pure integrity out of what they think is right, but surely it feels like quite a difficult. You know, it does the fact that a change of prime minister make it easy to take this quite awkward thing that's going to upset a lot of basically rich, powerful people and just say, you know what, let's just leave this and let Labour deal with it when they come into power?
Yeah, that is very much a risk and a threat, and possibly even a probability.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of these things. You know, if it was easy, we'd have done it many, many years ago. You know, this government does certainly appear to look like a government on its last legs, you know, fighting fires all over the shop. This is not a priority for them. New governments have the wind in their sails. They get to do stuff, right? They have a sort of wind of opportunity. So maybe we are waiting for a change of government. If this is your bag and this is what you want to happen, maybe that is your best chance. But however, it's not all Premier League clubs are against this. They are not a homogenous block. There are clubs who are massively opposed. There are clubs who aren't that bothered, and there are some clubs who quite like it. And even within the Championship, I'd say the same. There are clubs that are really up for it, and there are clubs that are not that bothered. I don't meet many in the EFL who hate it. I mean, one or two bits of it. But I can't reveal all the Premier League clubs, so we'll be sort of giving a lot away. But there's some quite surprising clubs who don't mind this idea at all. Don't mind it. And you're right, a lot of it is in the implementation. So, you know, how would an independent regulator work? Where would it sit, like physically? How big would it be? Scope of its powers. Various compromises have been mooted, and one that appeared to be the sort of popular one was that it would be sort of sit close to the FA, and perhaps, you know, sort of share, well, maybe some share some staff, and there would be a little bit of overlap. I mean, that's not great, because that's not full independence, but these are the things that people do want to sort out. And the Premier League have obviously pushed back hard. The Premier League as an organisation pushed back hard. You know, what's it for? And there's also, I think, quite a strong body of opinion out there that just needs to be convinced that regulation kind of works. And I often hear this, well, what has regulation done for the water industry? What's it done for da-da-da-da-da? And it's a little bit of whataboutery, and it's sort of, yes, there's poor, useless waste of time regulation, and there's effective regulation, You know, Tracy Crouch wasn't advocating rubbish regulation. She her background is financial services, and she was thinking in terms of, you know, how that industry is regulated. It's not perfect, but there is, but there is a model there that works, and that certainly in the last 15 years, sort of post 2008 crash, has been effective. And that's what she was thinking. Now, making that work for football, yeah, there's more thought that is required. And she was quite careful in that she wasn't too prescriptive. You know, she did want her document, her review, to be the beginning of a conversation as to how we make this work. And unfortunately, what's happened is people have just gone, yeah, let's do it now. And the other lot have gone, no, this is a dreadful idea. So there hasn't been a conversation. You know, football hasn't taken her invitation to, I genuinely think independent regulation is a great idea. And a lot of people have gone, yeah, that's a great idea. But there hasn't then been the conversation, the grown-up adult conversation about, all right then, well, let's try to make this work. What does it mean? So that's the problem. Can we get there? Yeah, we can get there. Will we get there? I honestly don't know.
Well, we've got loads more to get through before you have to leave us. We better move on. I think we could probably talk about that all day. But the other big story dominating the EFL off the field in the media in the last couple of months has been the TV rights, with the Sky deal expiring in 2024. Reports, obviously, I'm not privy to any of this, but reports that the EFL are looking at options in terms of streaming, looking at the possibility of getting rid of the 3 p.m. blackout. There was a report in the national press around a Danish streaming company already being sounded out. It feels like things might be changing in terms of the way that the EFL is marketed, at least worldwide, if not nationally. Do you have any update on what, where the EFL are on this, and what it could mean long term for the future of the TV rights?
No real update, but I could only, you know, kind of confirm that all those things are in play. That Sky deal was a controversial deal. It took a while to get over the line. It took almost like over a year, I think, to actually be signed. And it was Sean Harvey's, the former chief executive, sort of last piece of work. It still divides people. There was a sort of perception among some championship clubs that it was a disaster. It was a 5-year deal. It was an increase on the previous deal. Clubs like Derby, Leeds, Villa, who were EFL at the time, were furious. They thought they'd be massively underchanged. They thought they'd given away way too many rights to Sky, particularly in terms of streaming, and that Sky doesn't show everything. And those clubs made life pretty hard for Harvey and the rest of the EFL. On the flip side, it was a decent increase over the previous one at a time when the other domestic deals, including the Premier Leagues, were running out of steam. And I think I'm right in saying it's the last big bump that English football has got domestically, and did give them certainty. And it's given them certainty during this, you know, what we were saying in the sort of first answer, or, you know, talking about COVID, and has looked better over time. But the world has changed. And again, there's a sort of COVID element to this. We got used to being able to watch a lot of football, and we're 5 years further down the road of the sort of streaming. It's not a revolution anymore. It's reality, isn't it? You know, talking about Netflix is old hat. You know, people and this idea that everybody knows that you can watch a hell of a lot of football abroad, loads, and there are ways to watch it at home. So the world has changed, and this idea that you hand over all these rights to this massive inventory of games to Sky, and they're only really interested in some of them, it does seem a bit weird. So these pressures that have always been there are now open for everyone to see. There is no, oh right, I don't know, how would streaming work? No one needs to be you don't need to explain that to anyone. So now, yeah, I think everything is on the table. The idea that there's only one kind of player in town, it has to be Sky, no. Do you go a different route and choose a different broadcast, be it BT or a new entrant, to really love you, to really kind of go, yeah, what's the EFL got? It's got massive inventory of games. It's got clubs in every town. It covers the entire length and breadth of the country. We could make this the absolute centerpiece of our strategy, of our kind of broadcasting strategy. That was one of the ideas that was pitched to BT not that long ago, about a decade ago, before they went all in on European football, by the way. There were senior people at BT that thought it fit better with their company ethos, but anyway, they went a different way. So you've got that. Is the EFL now kind of popular enough, sexy enough, attractive enough to break it up into packages, to have more than one broadcast partner? I think that's interesting as a concept. Is the EFL the perfect pilot, if you like, for English football, British football, to go direct to consumer? Now, the Premier League have been thinking about this for years. And do they do it with a sort of small overseas market? Could the EFL, be that sort of test, be that lab for them? All of these things are being discussed, all of them. And then, of course, you've got the whole iFollow element to it as well. So there's a lot at play. I don't have any new updates apart from telling you stuff that you and your listeners will already know. All of these things are being discussed. And there are lots of different ideas and theories out there. The next EFL deal is going to be fascinating to see which way we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll probably be biased here, having been part of Sky's coverage over the last kind of few years. But I do think there is a case here for EFL fans of thinking the grass might be greener, where, when you only have realistically one channel to show live games on, it's very hard to kind of compete with streaming services. But having, worked with the people who work in the EFL team at Sky, I think the level of coverage and detail that is given to this, what is effectively the second, third and fourth league, must be unparalleled across the world, I would have thought, in terms of the resource and the coverage that those leagues do get. And whilst I'm aware that League Two fans probably wish there was more League Two football on TV, realistically, when there is, again, one channel, it's a supply and demand thing, and it's got to be a business decision. So, as in the job that I do, I have at times had legal, I should say, access to 3 o'clock games. I live an hour and 45 minute drive probably from the Kassam Stadium. So when I go and use my season ticket at Oxford, it's basically a 4 hour round journey. And I can categorically tell you that if I look outside on a Saturday morning and I see it's raining and it's cold, and I know that I could either sit on the sofa and watch it on my sofa and then, close the laptop or turn off the TV at 10 to 5 and be at home, or I can do the round trip, even for me, and I love live football and I would normally still get in the car, it's a decision to be made. And it does worry me that if you get rid of that 3 p.m. blackout, yes, clubs, and this is one thing I want to ask you, clubs will want to chase the golden egg of streaming and be able to market worldwide and be able to, try and bring in massive audiences. It feels like taking a 1% chance for what is, sacrificing match day revenue and your core local support. And do, are clubs, from what generally willing to take that chance? Like, are they looking at the streaming option, or does the idea of getting rid of the 3 p.m. blackout fill them with dread?
It depends who you ask. I mean, have a look on Twitter on a Monday. You'll see Andy Holt, and it provokes a lively debate, and you can see how the debate tends to break down. It you're absolutely right. These are key business decisions, right? Do we kind of rip up that model that has worked by and large for 100 plus years of incentivizing, prioritizing, maximizing the match day fan, the pie, the pint, the program, the ancillary spend around the ground, that direct relationship, the most direct relationship we have with our customers, sell them stuff, physically sell them stuff? Or do we risk, you know, losing some of that 10, 15, 25%? Well, they lost it. They lost it during COVID. So they know the value of that fan. Do they try and replace that? Now, all businesses know that things change. You know, our business, right? Papers. Fewer people buying the physical products. You don't stop printing papers.
Mm.
In fact, you move. You move gradually. You know, behind paywalls, websites, apps, etc., podcasts. And you replace that physical £1, £1.50, whatever it is these days, purchase for something else. And the football clubs have this same dilemma. Now, it's not the same for all of them. Now, I don't mean to pick on Andy's club, Accrington Stanley. You know, is the classic community club. It supports its town, and it's supported by its town. Those are his customers. But he does share a league. Wonderful. This is the magic. This genuinely is English football's unique selling point. The pyramid, that there is a league where there's an Accrington, but there's equally an Ipswich, and you know recently a Sunderland and all that, and a Plymouth, and all the other big clubs, a Sheffield Wednesday, Derby County, who do have an audience abroad, they do.
Mm.
But there are half. Accrington's not the only club that would not sell that many streams.
Mm.
So how do you, it's hard enough already within English football to get the distribution right. So that is the challenge, and it's I'm not saying it's easy, but equally, I've worried about the 3 o'clock for a while. That it feels from another time, and there is so much illegal streaming, so much piracy going on, that I just worry that if you resist that for too long, you end up really damaging the product, damaging the value of rights. And I don't know exactly when that moment comes, but I sense we're very close.
So from the general to the kind of specific, and you know, most fans listening to this will probably have some questions about their club off the field, but we don't have time to go through 72. So we'll cover off some of the high profile ones, and obviously important to remember that you are out in Qatar. So have bigger fish to fry over the last kind of 10 days or so. But let's talk about Birmingham and West Brom, who are two kind of big EFL clubs who are going through changes behind the scenes with Birmingham.
Yep.
It's been a pretty long, drawn-out takeover with Maxi Lopez and Paul Richardson, including some pretty interesting stuff, subplots with, Bassini's tirade on TalkSport and the EFL charge. 30th of November seems to be the kind of date in Birmingham fans' diaries. Where are we in terms of that takeover?
Well, it's a really good question. Look, I've not been in touch with them for 10 days, 2 weeks, but I was in regular contact with them before, talking to people around the game as well. The issue of Birmingham is, there's several, but I think the key one is the current ownership. And there's a theme here. The wave of Chinese investment in European football, English football in particular, is over. Not only is it over, it was a disaster.
Mm.
With Wolves perhaps being the single exception, but that's coming to an end as well. I know it's not your show, but it's all
might be next
it's all over. It might be. It's all over, right? they've all been told to get out, close those positions, come home. Some of them in a state of disarray. Some of them it's a more orderly retreat, like Wolves. Birmingham is an example of a disorderly retreat and a ludicrously opaque, confusing ownership structure that almost certainly broke rules in the past. And this is, you know, the EFL gets, as I said, some things right, it gets some things wrong. Sometimes it's just totally out of its depth. This is one of those examples. So you have the problem of a club that is hand to mouth at the moment. Stadium is a mess. Okay, work's happening there. They've been in trouble in recent seasons. Who really owns them? Who is it? And the EFL, rightly being very concerned about sanctioning a takeover that everybody knows must happen. Everyone knows that. But being very concerned about future litigation, someone coming out of the woodwork saying, hold on a minute, someone sold my shares. That person did not have the right. I have a piece of paper here that stands up in court in this jurisdiction to say, I've been wronged. Now, that would be a disaster. You then get into whole competitive integrity issues around, you know, around a league. It's just a nightmare for a competition organiser. So you've got the classic sort of Birmingham, well, it doesn't matter which club it is, you know, club, financial issues, must be sold. You know, a group who are there in place, some questions to ask about how much money they have and legitimate questions that they perhaps overpromised. You know, the infamous, the deal is done in the car park was unwise. But you know, Richardson's a fan. He's been trying to get the club for a while. Pacini was just a clown. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm apologising or why I would be shocked by that. But the issue is how do you sanction that takeover when you don't have key answers? Who's selling the club? Okay, can I have a word with them, please? Right, are you okay with this? Okay, great. What? If you now own the club, have you ever done the owners and directors test? Because that's a problem. So we've got various things going on there, and it's a mess. It's a mess. And you know the owners, people on the paperwork, don't really want to sell at the moment because they have this Hong Kong listing, and that's valuable. It's more valuable than the club. Oh, you know, it's just we could be talking about a different club and a different dynamic where the property's worth more than the club. But it all boils down to this horrible sort of zombie ownership that don't give a monkeys about football, never gave a monkeys about football, won't get out of the way because they can't get out of the way. And the EFL stuck in the middle. So there are no good answers at the moment at Birmingham. None. However, apart from, you know, the fact that they've certainly, last time I looked, they were playing pretty well. They managed to get some young players together, and there was some hope and optimism on the pitch. So, yeah, a competent running of a football club, shocking, shocking, and shameful running of a business.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And I think Craig Gardner and Johnny Sisters have a lot of credit for the way that they are and getting stuff sorted on the pitch. One takeover that looks like it is going to get done that we won't be able to speak about at length here is Coventry with Doug King buying the club. Finally, there are stadium issues with a £25 million bid from King to buy it, seemingly not being successful with Mike Ashley having an exclusivity around a £17 million bid. And then William Storey, who Sunderland fans will remember, tweeting that he is consulting his lawyers. Mike Ashley, William Storey, names of ghosts of Christmas past in the football world, really. That might set some alarm bells ringing for Coventry fans, but let's hope that Doug King's takeover goes through and is successful. But let's just quickly touch on West Brom before we let you go. Guo Chanelet, their owner, admitting to borrowing money from the club he hasn't paid back. MSD Holdings from Derby County time popping up again. West Brom fans pretty terrified, and unlike Birmingham and Coventry, seemingly no light at the end of the tunnel at the moment.
No. I've been talking to our West Brom correspondent about this for a while, and you know, I know there's some good reporting coming, and it's already been done. I don't mean to terrify anyone, but yeah, West Brom are a concern, a big concern for me. And again, it's that Chinese issue. It's that kind of retreat of Chinese money. Is it going to be done in an orderly way, or is it going to be done in a disorderly way, like kind of Wigan? I'm very concerned about West Brom. They are not having the sensible, serious conversations that they need to be having. They're not being realistic about the price. There is a mess that lies taking money out. And they don't appear to be honest about how it's going back in, or don't appear to be straightforward and punctual about how it's going back in. You know, he's like the Glazers. He's taking dividends out of the club. It's him and the Glazers. You know, the Premier League, the parachute money appears to have gone. I've not looked recently. They weren't playing very well. Yeah, I'm worried about West Brom. Very worried.
Yeah, things going to get a bit better under Carlos Corberan. But off the pitch. Yeah, reasons for concern. Matt, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule in Qatar to talk to us. And yeah, hopefully when we speak to you again soon, the Birmingham takeover has gone through. William Story is not threatening legal action against Coventry anymore. And West Brom are under new ownership. The fans can get behind.
Yeah, indeed. All right.
Cheers, Matt. Thank you. Speak soon.
Good luck with everything. All right, take care. Bye-bye.